What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the defense. Joining me again is Spencer Peterson. Spencer, how you doing?
You know, I've been better in terms of the Ravens, Ken, but the holiday season, it's hard to be in too bad of spirits here.
All right. I can manage to be in bad spirits. I've been through this in the first episode. I don't need to do it again. Anyway, the Ravens lose a critical game. We talked about a lot of things they did either schematically or elevation-wise in the first episode. Please go back and take a listen to that. I think there's some good discussion there about activating four defensive linemen, basically activating a fifth outside linebacker instead of a fifth defensive lineman, which seemed inexplicable to me. We talked about the tough game Alohi Gilman had in terms of really making plays at the catch point in particular. Talked about some of the dominance of Travis Jones. I'm sure we'll get back to that in this episode. And some of the pass rush issues the Ravens had. They got a pretty good, they put a pretty decent opportunity set together in terms of the defensive value of it against Drake May. And Drake May just carved him up despite having not the best opportunity set. But he did very well with ATS and very good with pressure.
Yeah, this is one where I think the only solution might have been to control the ball a little bit better. We mentioned the snap count disparity. I think it was something, looking back here at the numbers, 71-54 to the Patriots' benefit. And this is one kind of like you would talk about back in the, you know, Peyton Manning days, the best defense is actually just to keep him off the field. And maybe that's how the Ravens could have actually salvaged that a little bit better.
Yeah, good point. I mean, they did get him off the field a couple of times on turnovers, I guess, but they needed more offense to generate more first downs. And you know, basically one key one would have gone a long way. And the couple other turnover opportunities they didn't convert, one by Gilman and one by Wiggins, would have really helped to get one of those two. So we talked about a little bit of that in the first show. We don't need to go into it any further. This is part of the show where we talk about some individual players on defense in this game. Who would you like to start with?
I think we teased it at the end of the last show, but Ardarius Washington, that's really happy to see him back. I think you and I talked about, I don't know if it was on one of the off-season shows with the signing or something like that, and the news had just broken that he had torn his Achilles, and I have to eat a little bit of crow here. I think I was basically laughing at the notion that he could be back at some point this year, which I think Harbaugh had mentioned, and sure enough, he's back and he's playing quite well. He only played 30% of the snaps last night, but you know, had a clear impact. I think he had two quarterback hits, had the forced fumble. Reminds me a little bit of Tavon Young to pull a guy from years back, undersized but just a complete bulldog. You know, making plays all over the field despite being a cornerback. Tavon Young being a cornerback, Ardarius being a, you know, a nickel coming out, and then, or sorry, he was a safety and they played him at nickel a little bit, and but yeah, he's just a guy who plays well above his size and really excited watching him play.
Yeah, a hell of a player. And, you know, they used him as a pass rusher pretty much at will. And the one time he gave away his rush, he got a sack anyway. And then he didn't give away his rush and he got a quarterback hit. It's just exciting to see him go in there and be very slippery relative to some of the running backs he typically gets picked up by. Outstanding player.
There was one pass that was completed on him where it was just outside of his fingertips. He was in the right place.
Yes.
You know, just being a smaller player with shorter length. I don't know. Probably would have had to have several inches further on his arms to have made a play on the ball, but he seemed like he was in the right place and just kind of just beyond his fingertips. But that was the one kind of negative play that jumped out. But overall, I was just really excited to see him on the field producing and making splash plays.
Negative play by result. Good risk.
Yes. Yes. No, I think that's one. And I think there's a lot of this where you're forcing the quarterback to put the ball in the exact right place. And, you know, if that ball had drifted just a little bit, you know, to the, I guess the quarterback's right, kind of up the field a little bit, that could have been going the other way. So,
or even knocked down. I'm trying to remember the play and what down it was on, but I thought this would, that was a high leverage down as well. Like that was a get off the field down there. If they,
I think it may have been. And even though it was just beyond Ardarius's grasp or his hand, it's a really tough throw for the quarterback to make there still, just because it's a very flat angle towards the sideline. And so, again, I think this falls in the camp of you do have to just tip your cap a bit to what the Patriots were able to do in that regard. Not that I'm not frustrated with some of the decisions or the play of the Ravens, but that's one that does fall into that category.
Right. I'm with you on that. Very fine player. I'll move on. I'll talk about Travis Jones a little bit. 8 pressure events in this game. Had 7 pressures that were all him. And that means he was the first pressure on the play. They used him all sorts of different ways. They stunted him as the, you know, as a looper a fair number of times. And they stunted him one time on these under. And I often talk about what can happen and how the under player has a pretty significant advantage. So it's the pick player, you might describe him as, but the player who usually dives into an either an A or B gap is blocked by 2 players at the same time. Usually in this case, I believe it was a center guard and not, no, it was actually a guard left tackle. That's what it was in this case. And in this case, both sides of it peeled off to block somebody else. And he was left to just run. Right. It was almost like he didn't know where he was for a second. And then he was left to run free for an easy pressure on that play. They did not run against him. Now they did two things. The Patriots did 2 generalized things in this game is, they kept the pass plays away from Kyle Hamilton, and they took the run plays and took them away from Travis Jones. So between the tackles, they hardly run at all. And that it's true that it's a little bit of the natural way of the New England Patriots to try and run off tackle more than between the tackles. But they didn't run anywhere A or B gap for the whole game. They had, and when Jones is on, they didn't do any of it at all. They had 4 rushes for 9 yards between the B to B when Jones was on the field. So that was something. He didn't have a tackle, by the way, the game, which was something when I was looking this up, I was like, okay, wait a minute. How did that happen? He didn't end up with a tackle in a game like this, where he was, you know, pushing people around so easily. And it was just, he was on for 14 run plays, but they only ran 4 of them between the tackles while he was there. And I would say the Patriots, they, with the speed they have, they really like to run off the edge.
Yeah. He being Travis Jones is just so impressive and has gotten better and better every single year. He's an absolute force in the middle of that defense. And again, I know I've belabored the point that I'm excited to have him back, especially at the contract they were able to get him at. But I don't think the Ravens have had a interior defensive lineman that affects both the pass game and run game simultaneously in such a way since Holodinata.
Yeah.
They've obviously had some great interior defensive linemen, you know, Matt Abike more from the pass rush side of things, Brandon Williams more from the run stuffing side of things. You know, Brandon Pierce has been that guy at times, but just, no one has been the absolute force in the middle of the defense, interior defensive line, as Travis Jones has been nobody has been a force like Holodinata up until Travis Jones, I would say.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that would be the last one. I was trying to go through in my head quickly who were the other Ravens players who were as good in terms of the dominance against both. And Sam Adams, maybe. And he was only here for 2 years, but he was a hell of a ball player when he was here. And think about who else might really be even in that group. But there isn't anyone. I mean, Kelly Gregg was not a one-dimensional run stopper. That was his primary bent as a player. If you want to take somebody like Trevor Price, maybe, but I don't think he was the kind of
sort of a different player type, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a lot of very good interior defensive linemen, but I just don't think any have been. And to be fair, there's not many guys in the NFL right now who are playing at the level of a Travis Jones in the interior defensive line. So that's not a slight against any of the guys they've had. He's just such a unique skill set in terms of what he brings in multiple phases of the game.
Yeah. I mean, you could maybe you could take Calais Campbell as a guy who would be an interior defender the same. And he's a down lineman, but he's more of a end, and he certainly could play a pure defensive end in a 4-3 as well too. But yeah, rare skills.
Yeah. So my next guy, Green, I think excited to see, you know, him continue to do things on the field that athletically, you know, he, but for his off the field question marks, would not have been available where the Ravens picked him. Some of the moves, even when the results aren't translating yet into actual, you know, sacks or what they may be, some of the moves you see him put on offensive tackles are just so impressive, and things that we haven't had from a lot of edge players recently. You know, surprising not to see him on third down a lot this game, but you know, he continues to be a guy that impresses me.
I want to amplify what you just said about the third down play. So he played 31 snaps. That includes the penalties. So he was on for 12 first downs, 13 second downs, 5 third downs, and 1 fourth down. Now, until this game, they'd be having a lot of trouble finding snaps for Green. But the snaps, and these are the ones, okay, again, that include penalties, 31 for Green, 36 for Van Noy, 45 for Jones, and 48 for Robinson. So there's numerous things in there that we could talk about, and we probably will over the next course of the next 20 or 30 minutes or so. But it's incredible that this is the decision they've made, Rob, to make him more of a multidimensional player who has got to be good against run and pass, as opposed to using him in a situational pass rush role, which is what I thought would be the result of this. But they've decided on the high leverage downs, where they had 3 outside linebackers on the field for a lot of them, that Jones, Robinson, and Voinoy would be the 3.
Yeah. And I would say it might be a little surprising on its face if, you know, Robinson is typically the guy you would think of being that run stuffing, you know, that's been his calling card. When they were in those rush looks with 3 off outside linebacker edge players, was he normally shifting inside, or where was he playing in that alignment? That makes a little bit more sense. But yeah, no, it is surprising. And I'm with you that apparently it's my prerogative this show to just bring up players from the past, but I thought he was going to follow the Terrell Suggs developmental path of, you know, high leverage pass rush only, focus on that. You know, that's your calling card, get one thing right, and then we'll build into a more full complement of skill set and moves kind of years 2 and beyond. But maybe this will confer benefits with, you know, the departures we're looking to see in the edge room. He's going to have to take on a bigger role next year, but right now it is a little confusing that, or a little surprising that they haven't followed that developmental trajectory that you and I both sort of expected.
Yeah, I think it is surprising. And I think, you know, mentioning Terrell Suggs is perfectly reasonable in terms of Ravens history. He played 39% of the snaps as a rookie and got 12 sacks. And, you know, he grew into a player who ended up playing 95% of the snaps by the time he won the Defensive Player of the Year. So, you know, massively overused as an outside linebacker, frankly, but he was able to handle that kind of a role. Green, I don't see him with his frame as being a guy who will ever be and in fact, I'm not sure the Ravens will ever have another player who's a 90% plus percentage of snaps guy at outside linebacker. It's hard for me to imagine that they'll do it just because their kind of belief in rotation at the position. But it's Green is a guy I really expected would be used as a situational rusher. And he's never really gotten that opportunity yet. Looked pretty good, by the way, in terms of what he got in terms of pressure for the kind of snaps he was in there. So if you're in first and second down, you're probably getting less good opportunity to rush the passer, period. The linemen aren't giving it away. You can't pin your ears back. You got to be playing half run, half pass. Want to think of it that way. But he did a good job. And he got, you know, a couple times he flushed May, and he did have a quarterback hit in the game as well. So I thought, you know, there was definitely some positives to take from this. All right, I guess it's my turn here. Let me get back to my notes. Let's talk about Van Noy, and we'll stick with the outside linebackers here for a moment. He's become now exactly what Owe was before he left the team, which is a pure situational pass rusher. 32 of 36 snaps came as a pass rusher. And he did drop to coverage four times. And by the way, one of them was a very important play in the game to get a pass defense. Was pass defense right before the interception? I'm trying to think of where it was, but I think it might have been a couple of plays before. It might have been where's the PD? Yeah, it was four plays before the interception. So on third and one, he knocked the ball away. They converted on fourth and one. And then on the next third and 14, they threw the interception to end that very first drive. But Van Noy's play was right at the goal line. It was one of the few times in this game that they went to the catch point and took the ball away from a receiver of any sort. You know, there's just too many frustrating catch point, non-wins in this game. That was bad. But he looked very good as a pass rusher, too. He had five pressures. He had a quarterback hit that was negated by the holding penalty on Humphrey, I believe it was. That ticky-tack garbage call on Humphrey. Actually, that was a quarterback hit by Roquan that was negated on that. So not sure where his negated one was. It came later on an OPI. It was negated by an offensive pass interference, actually. So anyway, he left one on the field as well, or left one off the score sheet. Let's put it that way. But I thought he had a good game.
Yeah. Interestingly, kind of traditional stat sheet, you know, no tackles recorded, but, you know, watching him on the field, seemed like he had one of his better games of the season. It'll be interesting to see what they do with him next year. Probably a player where they were better off not giving him, any sort of meaningful extension, and probably a guy that, you know, they sort of go with the couple core guys they have, young guys they have for the future, and kind of reshuffle the deck in terms of the, adding one of the aging pass rushers that's available in the market.
Okay, so you're on a job interview with the Baltimore Ravens. And their question for you in their player development department is, why should we make a contract offer to Kyle Van Noy, or what should we be willing to pay Kyle Van Noy in 2026? What would you say about that?
I think you offer him a deal that you would be very happy for him to accept. You do not, probably, you know, maybe 20%, 25% below what you think is the fair price where you'd be sort of indifferent to having him. Because I think, one, you need to bring some sort of youth into the room. Two, there's probably, you can get better results from, as they've shown time and time again, of, you know, going out to the kind of the pile of discarded pass rushers and doing better. But I think, you know, if you think the fair price of production for him is $6 million, I think you make him a $4 million offer or something like that, where you believe there's excess value on that contract. You do not give exactly what you think is kind of fair market value plus $1, if that makes
okay.
sense.
Is there a is there a term of agreement that would be the longest you would go? Or would you sign a 3-year deal with him if you wanted that?
I think the most I would do is 2 years. Where he is and where he's what we've seen relative to last year, I think a 3-year deal kind of scares me.
I think a 2-year deal scares the hell out of me, but that's, I was kind of setting you up for that. I know, but I think this is kind of a classical old maid situation where an older player wants to get paid for 2 years and get a signing bonus that basically overpays him for the first year of that deal and allows the team to spread it out for more over that. But we saw that from Mason, from Reed at the end of his career. There've been others too, but those are the big two that come to mind, among Ravens. I think Yanda actually at his last deal was a two for one deal. But
well, I think he had a couple kind of sequentially or rolling that, down the stretch there where they kept tacking on years with Yanda. Okay. But, yeah, I think, Van Noy's his current deal was a 2-year deal, right? That is paid off. And he was a little, yes. I guess there were murmurings that he was unhappy about it in the off season.
Murmurings but, from him.
From him, okay, yeah.
At the podium.
Who? It's a good source to go to.
Yeah.
For the report. But just because that one worked out isn't a good reason to necessarily say, okay, we'll do it again. But I think regardless of exact term or numbers, I think this is a place where the Ravens, given what they've been able to do the last several years, are probably better off not tying up too much cap in known quantity and you know, making use of what they've been able to do and preserve scarce resources.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And somebody made the point to me is, why would you take any strategy away from the Baltimore Ravens when they've shown to be so good at finding value in various games that can be played? So why would you take away? And, you know, I'm a big non-proponent of leveraging your future cap by piling up a bunch of debt basically against that cap. But the argument, the most compelling argument that was ever given me was, and I don't even remember who did it, but they did a good job, was why would you take away yet another tool in the box of someone who is expert at gamesmanship with every tool? And, you know, it is something to be said. And if the Ravens are great at drafting players, you certainly don't want to trade your draft picks. You want to, if EDC is calling them lottery tickets, he doesn't really mean it, but each one of those things has real value. I think he's calling them lottery tickets so he can acquire them. I think that's the real reason why he's doing it. But this is a year where I'm really happy the Ravens have a lot of draft picks that they're working for.
Well, if they're lottery tickets where he has hit one less number than the other people, that's great. And I know some people will probably roll their eyes about this, but one really nice thing about the slightly over the hill pass rusher treadmill is that it is actually an incredibly effective way of refreshing the comp pick kind of carousel of, you know, with Jadeveon Clowney being the extreme example of this, where a guy you're able to get at a bargain price, potentially cut by some other team, comes in, has amazing production for you for a year, and then goes off, gets a big deal, and nets you a fourth round comp pick, or at least a fourth round comp pick in the formula. I forget if he actually translated or was canceled or what exactly happened there, but it's a very effective or efficient way of doing that as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't even know if that's what it was exactly, but you're 100% right. Whenever you could do that, and you can pick up a bargain player who you think you can spin into gold, you certainly have a good opportunity there. All right. We were talking about Van Noy. I think I brought him up, so I think it's your turn.
Yeah, I think for me, Jones, Draymond Jones is a guy I'd like to talk about. He, you know, had another sack, continues to be a great addition at the deadline to this team. And unfortunately, it's seeming like that other condition of his compensation isn't going to be hit, or at least right now it looks less than 50% likely to hit. But again, great acquisition.
Really going out on a limb there.
Yeah. More likely than not to hit. I was stumbling over the exact phrasing there of, yes, that it was not looking likely, but yeah, he might be a 10% good acquisition.
But yeah, he got that sack last night, and it's the first thing that comes to mind. Of course, he's met the condition, but then he hadn't met both conditions, so it would be a very good thing now if he met both conditions for I think it would be anyway. I'll trade the fifth up to a fourth to get a home playoff game.
I am at the bargaining stage of grief, and I would trade a third round pick. We can make it even. To...
That's perfect. That's perfect. All right. Draymond's done a great job. Really finished up the sack well. That came off the initial pressure. I think it was initial pressure from either Van Noy or from... No, it was from Travis Jones initially on the sack minus three, where he chased him down. That's one of the things about the sacks that the Patriots did take in this game. They're all short yardage. There's four sacks for six total yards. And if you can't remember, I can't remember the fourth sack. The ultimate trivia question is, there are now two players, I believe, in Ravens history who have both a reception and a sack for the Ravens. Now, if you can get both of them, I'll be very impressed. But the one from last night is Tez Walker. He got a sack on the punt. And I don't know, there may be another one as well, but the other guy is
Levine?
No, it's a converted because I don't think Levine ever had a reception for the Ravens. He did have a big run against Miami that
time. I knew he had some runs, so I was wondering if he was the beneficiary of one of those Sam Cook passes at some point. But
that could have been, but as a personal protector, he wouldn't really have that option. But the guy who did it was the guy that converted from defensive end to tight end, and maybe he was going the other way. I'm not sure. He went from tight end to defensive end, and he had a sack. I want to say it was around 2010. He hardly got any playing time ever for the Ravens, but if I'll kind of look through it as we go. But he had about a 25-yard catch at one point. It was at the end of a game where they shouldn't have been throwing the football because it was kind of like poor sportsmanship because they're clubbing the other team. And the backup quarterback was in. He hit a pass completion to this converted tight end, who had also a sack. And so Tez Walker now has both as well. But it's a remarkable play. I mean, this is the kind of play that Walker, you know, that goes on his career highlight wheel to show his grandkids. I mean, it's just one of the coolest plays of his whole career.
Yeah, no, great play by Walker. To what degree, and maybe there's no discretion here, and it was a slam dunk call, but what degree does the official scorer have in whether or not that's a sack or just a tackle? Sometimes when you see, you know, a halfback pass kind of play where the running back gets taken down, it doesn't seem like it always gets awarded as a quarterback or as a sack, even though, you know, the player, whether it was a runner or a receiver, was clearly initially looking downfield to pass it. So I was actually a little surprised when I saw in the stat sheet that was scored as a sack. I thought it might have just been considered a special teams tackle.
Yeah, so like a run, would have been, and he gave up on the pass pretty quickly on the left side. The Ravens had a couple,
and that's another part of it.
Yeah, so you know, by him rolling out on that side, it looked like there wasn't a receiver he's looking for, you know, secondarily. So it did look like he was trying to throw, but once he gives up on the pass, it's kind of like it had to be a sack. That's really the only option. I mean, he didn't immediately move towards the line of scrimmage on the typical dive play. So I don't really know. I don't know what discretion they have. I do know this, that even though they'll make the official rulings they'll make the quote unquote official rulings, which are preliminary official rulings in the game book at the stadium, then those could be reviewed and teams can say, well, wait a minute, I think this should have been a sack for such and such a player. You had this tackle miscredited or whatever. They do that. And there's a set of those that have to go in. I don't remember if that's been by Tuesday or Wednesday. And then maybe Thursday is review day and they change what they want to change. And one of the big ones was quarterback hits were not an official statistic for a number of years, including the early days of PFF. So while there were changes in sacks, there weren't changes in quarterback hits, which was really weird and caused some anomalies to occur. There could be a change in a sack that would trigger a quarterback hit change, but there wouldn't be ever a change to a quarterback hit alone. So kind of some funny things.
Well, maybe Tez Walker and the Ravens will send a letter saying that they really believe it should stay a sack because that's a really cool thing to have on his on his career numbers.
I'm going to find out who that player is before long here. Now you brought up Draymond. I thought Trenton Simpson played probably as well as could be hoped. Difficult game for him. He's at weak side linebacker. He did play 53 snaps, and we saw this is second highest count of the season. If you're thinking about, oh, when did he have a higher count? He was in that Houston game where he's forced into the Mike role and was replacing Roquan for a game he was out. So that obviously wasn't optimal circumstances, and the Ravens' performance that day certainly mirrored that. But they did not show the same desire to get him off the field for dime situations in this game that they had against the Bengals. Against the Bengals, they were looking for any reason, second and seven, second and eight, to get him off the field. They didn't do that in this game against the Patriots, and they stayed with Simpson for longer. And in fact, Simpson played in several of the dime packages as a roving pass rusher as well. So it wasn't just he was taken off the field in those packages.
Yeah, I liked what I saw from him in this game. He continues to show the athleticism of, you know, why they liked him in the first place, just kind of screaming and just flying around the field. It was good to see him record the sack. Seems like a guy that at least has a role in this team next year. You know, it's always questionable. He's going into his fourth year, I believe, right? Or is this his second year? No, he'll be going into his fourth year next year. But no, excited to see him flying around, looking good. But unfortunate that it came under the circumstances it did with injury opening the opportunity. But glad to see him make the most of it.
Yeah.
Great. If nothing else, maybe talk about Hamilton next.
Okay.
Seemed like I think you mentioned before that the Patriots seemed to be trying to go away from him on passes, but he really made his presence felt at least early in the game, and continues to be, basically any field he walks on, he's the best player on the field at the time, at least on defense.
Yeah, it sure looks that way. The play, it still is astounding to me what he can do to much bigger men with long arms and the leverage he plays with, and how much it reminds me of Ted Hendricks early in life and watching him play. But he was in there. He pancaked Jared Wilson. And Jared Wilson is a third round pick, I think, out of Georgia. It might be a second round pick, but he's a fairly high pick, rookie playing as a starter in his rookie year for the New England Patriots. I mean, he's in a pretty good place. He made him look like a small guy. He pushed him right back, pancaked him. In fact, now there was some other trippable material in the way in the form of other legs and whatnot, but he pancaked him and then came in to make the tackle for -3 that not only set up 2nd and 13, but knocked not Ramondre Stevenson, but Henderson out of the game.
Yeah, just incredibly impressive player every time he does things like that. I'm still amazed, like you said, when he's throwing around offensive linemen to make a play in the backfield. That is one thing, you asked earlier, is there anything you can take from this game that, portends well for the future? And just the continued incredible play by Hamilton is something that sticks out. And happy also to see that he made it through a game without having to come off the field and get checked out. I think he played something like 100% of the snaps or 99% of the snaps. And that has been the one flaw with Hamilton, or maybe not flaw, but the thing that worries me about him is it seems like every game he is, coming off and getting checked out, and to not have that happen. Unfortunately, we had a very significant one on the offensive side of the ball, but
let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, this is Steve Gorman, radio host, sports commentator, former drummer for the Black Crowes. The winter holidays are here, a time for festive celebrations, family gatherings, and ringing in the new year. Whether it's a holiday party, a night out with friends, or just relaxing by the fire with a few drinks, it's a season full of good cheer. But here's something else to add to your holiday plans, a safe and sober ride home. Just like in sports and music, always have a game plan. And the most important part of any plan is sticking to it. If you plan to drink, take that plan a step further. Call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or have a designated driver lined up before the night begins. Drinking and driving is a decision that can change your life and the lives of others forever. A DUI, a crash, an injury, the consequences are real and lasting. So please, for your sake and for everyone else on the road, make the smart choice. Get a sober ride home. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
You know, for him to make it through healthy despite throwing his body around like that is encouraging.
Both of the Ravens' two best players, their best player on offense and their best player on defense, have to be used in circumstances for optimal usage that are suboptimal in terms of injury risk. Is there anything you would change about the use of either to try and minimize injury risk and keep them on the field?
As a simple answer, no. I think you have to make use of the weapons you have. This is too, you know, difficult of a game, and, you know, intentionally hamstringing yourself or limiting yourself because of you're worried about what could happen is a recipe for failure. There's obviously specific situations where I don't want Lamar in a blowout running, you know, running around the field when we're up by 21 points with 5 minutes left, but, you know, neutral game script, all else equal, I want these guys doing what they're best at.
Yeah. Okay. I'm in the same place. And I think Hamilton, maybe even more so, he's just, I've undercut the value to say he's the Queen of Hearts on the back end and the Ace of Spades on the front end. The difference is more than that is all I'll say. And it's, if they were forced to limit his usage to just being a good back end safety or just being a good strong safety, it would be very limiting. I'd want him to continue. All right, I guess it's my turn. We'll go with Marlon Humphrey. We got a question about Marlon that came in, so we'll kind of weave these together. Tough, obviously a very tough assignment when he had Diggs in this game. Didn't have him all the time, but he had him some. Wiggins had him some, and he had more difficulty covering Diggs in this game. He had 13 times he was targeted. That included the 37-yard rainbow. That wasn't Diggs. That was Williams by the right pylon, despite the fact that he had step-for-step coverage. But I'm personally at a point where I think he needs to move to safety. But let me get the question here, and then we'll do this. Okay, so this is from Brad McGowan. It says, hey, we love Marlon for the player he's been, but couldn't the team have done more to give him help last night? Why do the Ravens insist on playing him like he's an all-pro when he's not, and he's the cornerback with PFF's worst coverage grade?
Yeah, so if the question is could they have done more to help him, I don't know what that necessarily looks like. If you feel like you need to cover up for what he's playing, I think the answer is that maybe you don't have him on the field, and that's a tricky situation when Owuzie is out, was inactive with injury. And then it seemed like they didn't want to put either Tampa or Martin on the field based on usage. So I don't really know what the answer is for giving him more help. But in terms of looking to the future, I think his days as a full-time cornerback may be limited.
Right. I would agree. I think the move to safety may come next year. I think the Ravens have him under contract for one more year at $7 million. This is probably the perfect time to sit him down and have the discussion and say, hey, look, 3 years, $20 million, and let's see if you can move to safety next year kind of thing. I don't know the amount. I'm spitballing here, but I would hope that they could get him pretty cheap, honestly, and I think his skills could be portable to safety. I think he could play very well there. I think his time as a corner is probably coming to an end. I know he's been hurt this year and he's been working through some injuries to get it. This game was tough, and I'll address the help thing in another way. They had a too high look on the 37-yard touchdown pass. Gilman was way late getting over. And the truth of the matter is, he still wouldn't have been able to make a play on the ball because it was perfectly thrown, and he'd have to run right through the receiver to get to it. But Gilman was very late getting over. And it's they need another guy there who's going to do a better job on the back end in 2026. And hopefully they'll either have it with Ardarius Washington or maybe draft another safety. Doesn't have to be a high round draft pick, anything like that. The Ravens have proven themselves very adept at finding value further down the safety draft chart. But they need somebody else who can play the back end a little bit more robustly.
Yeah. And two things. One, to your comment about the portable skills, I fully agree. And I think some of the things we've seen Humphrey do last year and this year as well with, you know, picking off the ball, the three interceptions he's got, looks safety-esque at times in the way he is playing. And then, you know, the forced fumbles, the punch, the toughness to tackle, like these all seem scream safety to me in a lot of ways. And then the other thing I was going to say, and I really want to preface this with the fact that I really like Marlon Humphrey. I've liked Marlon Humphrey for a long time. I want him to finish his career as a Raven in whatever role they can figure that out to be. But when you say, you know, the mitigating factor is that he's been hurt, that's not an explanation that necessarily like makes me feel warm and fuzzy about the future of him. Of like, look, no, don't worry. He's just a cornerback who's, you know, getting a little bit older and has groin injury issues. Like that, that is not selling me on the, if anything, that is digging the hole deeper of how, you know, that what the outlook is.
That's right. That's right. The best ability is availability. And if you're a 30-year-old corner who has problems with availability, then that's a really significant issue. So I completely agree with you on that.
And not only availability, but, you know, it's not a dislocated shoulder. It's, you know, lower
body. It's
not
a transient injury. Yeah. Yes, you're right. All right. Let me go to a couple other questions here. We'll toss this out for you. Let's see. Got another one from Brad here. Okay, here's a good one. From Voss says, how would you divide the blame between Marlowe, Gilman, and Orr on the deep shot coverage? So I don't think he's saying specifically the one play to 37-yard touchdown pass. I think he's generally throwing out deep shots. I won't hold you to those three if you can find another person who's responsible for it. But what do you think?
It's hard not to talk about it in the context of a specific play because there's just so many things that you can point to. You know, if we were talking about the 37, and I realized that we just said we're not going to constrain it to that, but for example, on that one, there's a part that is, you know, not named, just amazing throw by May. On that one in particular, if I had to, you know, pin blame on one of the players that was involved or one of the factors listed, as you just mentioned, Gilman not getting over nearly fast enough. It seemed like Marlon had good position and maybe he could have done a little bit better, but probably lower down there. And I don't know what Orr could have done or called differently based on the way that played out. It seemed like Gilman should have been over and it seemed like Marlon was in the right place. And so I don't know how that one would be on Orr, but I realize the question is broader. I think Marlon generally had a tough game, as did Gilman. And I'm kind of waffling here, not giving a specific answer. And as I mentioned before, I had my qualms with, you know, Orr's willingness to obstruct the receiver's routes and, you know, mess up the timing. But I would say if I had to put anyone at the top of the list, it's probably Marlon in this game, just given physical limitations and what, you know, we saw with the receivers. But I think there's plenty of blame to go around.
Yeah, I think there is too. I might go 60-40 Gilman in this game among the players. You know? Yeah. Did Wiggins let up a play earlier on? Wiggins had the 25-yard play early on, and we talked about that the first episode, but that was a play where Gilman was right there at the catch point. PFF, you know, tossed the target on Wiggins for a 25-yard pass. But that, to me, that's a play that Gilman's got to make on the back end of that bracket, and he didn't get it done. He couldn't get up to the catch point to do it. Now, we saw Marlon make a play by some means against Booty that would have been a 50-yard play, and probably still should have been a 50-yard DPI. Not sure how I feel about that one. in terms of the one-on-one nature of that. So if you're saying that should have been a 50-yard play of some type that Marlon should have given up, well, then you're probably right. And then maybe
it's just incomplete. It was a good result.
So it's one of those things. I'll give you a third player. And that is, I think Malachi Starks has not lived up to what the Ravens, what all of us as fans have hoped that he would be. We hoped he'd be a highly cerebral quarterback reading, high instinct player who could play the back end. They're actually taking him off on a lot of downs. I missed 17 plays, I think, in this game. So he used to be the guy who was on for every snap, who was the 100% of the time free safety. That's not the case anymore. Gilman is the guy who's getting basically every snap, not quite every, but almost every. And Starks is a guy who, you know, that's the guy who's the future of the Ravens secondary. If anybody is, he's the guy that just drafted in the first round. I mean, you know, he's got to be the guy. He's allowed 9.9 yards per target this season. And even when you compare that to his brethren, and by the way, I had a great question about this a few weeks ago, and I'm not sure who asked it, but Starks was towards the bottom of players who had at least 300 snaps at free safety in terms of giving up yards per target. And surprisingly, some of the guys who were drafted early in this last draft are there. Not Emmanuel. Emmanuel is in a better spot, and he's also not got enough free safety snaps. But the guys who are in as bad a position are Watts and Makuba, who were both guys who I really liked a lot at free safety as well. So there's some probably adjustment period of the league. I'm still hopeful. You know, Malachi Starks is going to be a better player than he's been this year, but it's not a good sign that he's sitting out snaps either. So, you know, Voss, I can't give you an easy way to pin down all the blame on those players, because I don't think that's the extent of it. I think there's more people probably involved in it. Should Chuck Pagano have done more with the secondary? Would that be a fair expectation of where this team is right now?
You know, that's a funny one, because that's the one everyone points to of who needs, or at least they were pointing to, who needs to come down and, you know, out of the booth or wherever he's sitting to relieve Orr. But, you know, he was the secondary guru when he was with Baltimore, and that was his platform for getting to DC and then moving on. So maybe, and just quickly going back to Starks for a brief moment, it's a tough one to evaluate, right? Because it's very easy to look at the guys who are acutely responsible for a play, like a Marlon in this game. And it's very easy to point to, hey, that's the guy who's messing up. It can be very difficult at times to evaluate or to observe what's going on with free safety play. I think as evidenced by, you know, one example of that being, I think, the good year that Earl Thomas had, where if you look at kind of the coverage cloud or the passes cloud, there's just this dead spot in the middle of the field where he wasn't making a lot of splash plays or, you know, big interceptions. He wasn't having an Ed Reed-esque kind of interception year, but there was clearly an impact being made that would show when you would kind of do some visualizations like that. And it's not immediately observable of what's going on. And so on one hand, yes, maybe Starks is partially to blame, and when we throw the players in the mix. And two, it sort of points to the fact that that is a cause for optimism, potentially, whether founded or not, of something that clicks. That's, you know, you're not seeing a major limitation in his game, or you're not saying, okay, he's just too slow getting to this spot, or he can't do X, Y, or Z. It's a very kind of ephemeral thing that is hard to quantify. And maybe, you know, the light bulb goes off, or the switch flips, whatever metaphor you want to use. And that's an improved part of a reason for hope for improvement in the defense next year.
So I buy into that. So you're saying it could be transitory, that his instincts aren't as good this year, they'll improve naturally. And if he's on a normal runway, normal path, he'll, you know, he's going to look completely different as a third or fourth year player. And that's probably true. Everybody loved this guy. Everybody loved this guy. Everybody thought he was a great pick. I thought he was a good second round pick. It's not like I didn't love him too. I just didn't love him as much as everybody else loved him. I still think he's got a chance to work out and be very good. And I still can't help but be a little bit jealous of the fact that Seattle got him and Worry later, and he's worked out so far. So he has to work out for the Ravens. I mean, he just, there's too much. They have too much invested in And we have too much hope, frankly, and potential value invested in who Starks could be for him not to work out for the Ravens at this point.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's I'll give you another question here. This might be the last of them. Let's see. Okay, here's a good one. Zev Moses. Zev, this is the first time I remember you in the mailbag. Thank you for contributing. What do you think are the main problems with the pass rush? Lack of interior push, poor contain, edge guys, etc. Plus, how would you try and rebuild the group? Secondary had decent coverage at times, but there was no pressure. It may be fair to assume Matabike is not coming back. So start wherever you like on that.
Let's see. There's a lot of parts of that.
Yeah.
I think, while I'm not optimistic about it, I think some people may be too fatalistic about Matabike, just given we don't have any information about it, really. But I'm not very optimistic about it, but I wouldn't shut the door on it completely. Who's to say that's very speculative? So putting that aside, and I don't know that there's anything we can do about it. Getting to the potential explanations that were mentioned, I don't think it's a lack of interior push. I mean, what we're seeing from Travis Jones is remarkable. You know, it's not a situation where we just lost Matabike and there's nothing to backfill it. I think we're seeing in this game more than you could ever expect from an interior defensive lineman in terms of the push they're getting. I think there's a question on there, lack of contain. I don't think it's lack of contain. At times, I almost wonder if there's too much contain happening. When you try to rationalize what happened with OA going to the Chargers and unlocking something and getting some production, are they potentially asking too much of their edge defenders to, you know, watch X, Y, and Z while also rushing, while also doing this, that, or the other thing? And maybe that's slowing them down by a millisecond. It's really hard to say, and this is a bit of a cop-out, but it's much like the assignment of blame on the secondary players. With this defense, there just seems to be not too many things going precisely or specifically wrong that you can point to and say, hey, this guy can't get past his defender or his blocker, or this guy, you know, is just getting toasted on, you know, run by every single play. It's just some small random thing is happening way too often, and it's hard to point to, you know, the one weird trick that's going to solve everything. So that's not a great answer or a very satisfactory answer, but if I had to point to something, my speculation or my hypothesis might be that they've asked the edge guys to do too much at times, but I don't really have strong conviction on that.
All right. I maybe take a slightly different approach to this. I think the assumption always is that the Ravens don't get good pressure anytime they get lit up in the passing game. I actually don't think that was the case in this game. Well, they had one of their really good.
We had that crazy results. run of quarterback hits, which it was just, I was throwing my, we talked about it a couple times now, but I could not believe in that they were completing these passes. And I was just hoping that, okay, this has to get to him at some point, or, you know, speed up his internal clock or something. Like, we need to get something out of this, but.
Or knock him out of the game. I mean, yeah. You know, how about that? They had 10 quarterback hits in this game. They sacked May three times. They sacked whoever it was, Mapu on the punt. That doesn't really count, but they knocked him down a bunch of times, and somehow he kept getting up, including a really bad twist job by Ardarius Washington on his quarterback hit that I didn't think he was going to get up from. I really didn't. I thought his ankle was, you know, in another place. It was a fairly remarkable game. He had 16 ample time space, and he did terrifically well with them, but he had 20 times he was pressured, and he did terrifically well with them too. And it's a tough situation. You play an MVP quarterback, MVP level quarterback, and he lights you up, and he did it with a lot of throws that were frustratingly well placed at the catch point, such that the Ravens couldn't or didn't do anything about it. And it's true, they had a couple chances. They had a couple chances on interceptions to put the game away, most notably the Wiggins interception at the end of the game that wasn't. But I don't think it's really accurate to say that they didn't get any pressure in this game. I thought they did get pressure, and I thought, unlike some other games, it was actually effective pressure where they got the quarterback on the ground, as opposed to they just moved him out of the pocket, made him roll out to the right where he threw an easy completion. I mean, it's not there was none of that. There was some of that. And there were other plays where May ran for a first down or ran for yardage, you know, being forced out of the pocket. But, I wouldn't say it was accurate that they did not get decent pressure in this game.
Yeah. And maybe the way you just put that is much more coherent way of what I was trying to get out of, and I think actually more directly answers the question specific to the premise of it. But that's kind of what I was getting at, where, you know, it's not a situation where you look at this and you say, okay, there's not a single pass rusher that was able to get to May today, and he just had all the time in the world back there, and that's how they got carved up. You know, they're just, the individual components, when you look at them, don't seem that bad, and the results just, for whatever reason, just aren't following.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's where I am on this, in this case. I'm having a difficult time trying to say what would have been better, other than they needed to make some freaking plays on, they need to make some plays on the football on the back end. There's been a lot of times this year, by the way, where the coverage has done very well, being given very little by the pass rush. So don't get me wrong. That's been a reasonable general complaint about the 2025 Ravens. So I'm not minimizing your thing. I just don't think it was a really good rationale why that in this game it did not work out. But we respect the question. I really appreciate you contributing, Zev, and hope we'll see more questions from you again in the future.
And maybe just quickly, that last point about, you know, not making the play on the ball is sort of just a metaphor for the season to some degree. I think it was the first drive on defense against the Bills, where I think it was Starks jumped that pass and just wasn't able to bring it in. And that just seems to be the story of the year, honestly, like right there. And they just don't make the play, or they don't capitalize. They you know, make an ill-timed fumble or whatever it is. It just seems to be these little discrete moments that have hamstrung the season.
I mean, certainly, the Ravens, with the combination of offensive players and defensive players they have, they're supposed to be a turnover-generating defense. They're supposed to be a turnover-reducing offense, with having Lamar Jackson, a lower interception rate, having Derrick Henry, who hasn't really had fumble problems like this before. It's not supposed to be as bad as it's been this year. Zay Flowers, I think, is up there near the lead of all wide receivers in fumbles. He has three, and he was tied for third before when I looked. And I heard something about a lot of those have come on. There have been special teams has been a big contributor to some of the wide receiver fumbles that you see on the top of the list. So it's frustrating, and probably something he should work with in the offseason. It's funny because we just put out the One Last Thing episode where we each had to name one thing about Flowers' game that we didn't like. And one thing we talked about was Flowers' lack of hands, both in terms of catching the ball and in terms of fumbling the ball. It continues to be a problem. And it could be a matter of hand size in his case because he's a smaller guy. But it just always looks like he's handling the football with chopsticks to me.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of his too have happened in like comically bad situations. Of, you know, it is not a situation where none of them have seemed to come with the Ravens up 14 and, you know, way downfield, and the ball squirts out kind of at the end of a tackle, and they go on, and no one remembers it because they win anyway. It's been incredibly high profile moments.
Yeah, yeah, we certainly have had some of that. All right, that's it for the mailbag today. We appreciate all your contributions. Where do the Ravens go from here in their last two games? Is there anything specific? I mean, there's been talk of tanking, talk of other things. Is there anything they should do except try and play their hardest and beat the Packers?
So based on the sequencing piece, which I think you mentioned at the top of the show, they really have no choice but to do their best to beat the Packers and then turn their eyes to being the biggest Cleveland fans. And I think that's all they can do. And, you know, I detest the notion of tanking when you have, you know, anything resembling even the longest of shots, unless, you know, maybe if this were a situation where you had to have a one in a million result, but the odds are long, but they're not that long, that I don't think there's any, and just even the knock-on effects for future years of if you were to hang it up this season is just, I couldn't endorse that. And I don't think the team will or would.
I sure hope not. And I hope this is a game they leave it on the field and they try and beat the Packers. And, in some ways it's not the worst place to be against this Packers team, which probably understands they themselves can't get a lot from a win, as we talked about earlier. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, and maybe that plays into them, you know, not rushing a guy like Jordan Love out onto the field post-concussion. And that might we're down to the Ravens' benefit.
Yeah. Well, that would be nice if true. And hopefully the Ravens can find a way to have Lamar Jackson on the field. And if they can't, hopefully they get another Huntley miracle like they did against the Bears. And you look at that Bears game, boy, now in the context of what the Bears have accomplished this season is really remarkable.
Yeah, and Huntley's 2-0 against the Bears as a starter, isn't he?
Yeah. And yeah. One, the other big one that the Bears kind of shot themselves in the foot by scoring unnecessarily on a play where they could have kicked for the win. But yeah. All right. Spencer, pleasure talking football with you for a couple hours here. Thanks for making time. Tell folks where you can talk football with you online.
The best place is Twitter/X. You can find me at SpencerCP. Always happy to talk Ravens, Orioles, all things sports.
All right. Everybody out there, thanks so much for listening as always. Please recommend this show to one more person. We always appreciate that. If you want to do us a favor, write a 5-star, 50-word review. Hopefully that won't take you more than about 5-10 minutes on your favorite podcast platform. If it does, you're working too hard on it because it can be a lot less than 50 words, believe me, and it helps drive traffic to the show. And if you like the shorter form videos, take a look at them. It's always nice to get a little bit of algorithmic growth in addition to word of mouth. So they're out there on YouTube now. And they're 1 to 3 minute explanations and current situation videos that I've been doing. I'd like to expand. I'd like to have more explanation videos that would have some real life after longer. So if you think of a reason there, please hit me up with that. Spencer, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.